All right, Mr. Wininski, are you the only one who has checked in?
I guess so, Your Honor.
Okay. Ron, would you do me a favor and step outside and just make sure Cheryl Smith is not out there lost? Thank you for your patience.
I went to the office the other day and my garage door fell off its brackets and I was trapped for several hours, so thank you.
We understand that. We had someone whose car just stopped this morning, and so those things happen. Yes.
Your Honor,
okay. All right. All right. We have case number 215-249 and 253, both dash CV, Hoskins and Echol versus Rico Family Partners Limited. Mr. Wininski is here for the appellants. Ms. Smith apparently has not yet arrived, so we will proceed if Mr. Wininski would like to still argue. We have read your briefs, and we are also ready for argument if you would like to go over a few things.
I would, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, can I ask you before we start if you have had any conversation with Cheryl D. Smith about her not appearing here today?
No, Your Honor, I have not. I had a few calls from my office earlier, and I thought that might be because she was calling my office, but then I found it was the court calling my office. So.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, let's proceed.
May it please the court. I am here today representing Dennis Echol and Christopher Hoskins, and they are both appealing the denial of their special appearances based on the fact that they are California residents and did not commit any torts within the state of Texas. Now, I believe that there are two fundamental problems with the trial court's order in this particular case. First and foremost, the trial court expressly based its ruling on a doctrine that has been expressly rejected time and time again by the Texas Supreme Court. And for that reason alone, the orders are erroneous and should be reversed. The second fundamental problem is that after the individual defendants filed their special appearances and denied flatly that they had committed any tort within the state of Texas, the plaintiff did not come forward with evidence to substantiate its jurisdictional allegations. And under the Supreme Court precedent that we've cited in our brief, that is also fatal to their claims against these individual defendants. Now, as we've said in the brief, I'll make clear, we do not contest jurisdiction over Vista Ridge Limited Partnership, which is a Texas limited partnership, or Vista Ridge Corporation, which is a Texas corporation. Hoskins and Echol are limited partners in the partnership, and they're officers in the corporation, which is the corporate general partner of the limited partnership. Those defendants are Texas defendants. They're properly before the court. But we vigorously do contest jurisdiction over Echol and Hoskins individually. Now, the standard of review for special appearance jurisdiction is always a question of law for the court. The plaintiff does have the initial burden to plead sufficient jurisdictional allegations to confer jurisdiction over the non-resident defendants. Once the plaintiff does that or attempts to do it, the burden shifts to the defendant to negate the bases of jurisdiction alleged against it in the plaintiff's petition. And once the defendant does that with the verified special appearance, the burden shifts back to the plaintiff to introduce evidence to back up those jurisdictional allegations, or the plaintiff risks dismissal of its lawsuit. And in this case, as we stated, the plaintiff did not come forward with any evidence whatsoever.
So there was actually a hearing before Judge Hartling, and the plaintiffs introduced nothing.
That is correct, Your Honor. We have submitted the reporter's record from that hearing because at the time I took this case, I had not participated and thought out of abundance of caution we should get that. And that's been filed with the court, but all it is the lawyers arguing back and forth. They talk about pieces of evidence, but they don't introduce them. They talk about the note and the deed of trust involved and some of the other documents involved in the transaction, but none of those documents are ever tendered to the court on either side, I would say.
What about their claim that there was one document actually filed, I guess, with the trial court, a disclaimer I believe that was filed before the special appearance and their affidavits.
Okay. There were several amended petitions in this case.
Okay.
My individual defendants, Mr. Eckel and Mr. Hoskins, were named in the earlier pleadings, but were not named as defendants. They were simply named as persons who might have an interest in the subject matter of the controversy. And in response to that, both of those defendants filed a disclaimer of interest. Those do not constitute an appearance in this case because they were not requesting any affirmative relief from the trial court, nor did they recognize that the trial court properly had jurisdiction over the, I mean, they weren't even defendants at that time. So it's simply recognizing, yes, there is a suit pending, and we want nothing to do with it.
Thank you.
So what the plaintiffs did in this case is plead with very broad brush blanket allegations against all the defendants, claiming A, B, C, D, and E conspired to create a fraudulent lien on property, or A, B, C, D, and E acted in concert to create a false impression. And those blanket allegations are not sufficient under the minimum contacts analysis because each defendant's activities in the forum state have to be examined individually. And there's not a single statement in that fourth amended petition, which, by the way, was filed after the special appearances. There's not a single specific allegation in that petition that says Defendant Eckel, at this certain place in Texas, on this certain date, took this certain act with this other person. That does not appear. And I've listed in my brief, and certainly the court can look at the petition, but I've listed what I think are all the relevant allegations that could arguably cover Mr. Eckel or Mr. Hoskins as individuals. And again, most of them are blanket. The only two, I believe, that actually focus on Mr. Eckel and Mr. Hoskins, if you read the petition as a whole, you'll see that the actions that are complained of there could only have been done in their capacities as officers of the general partner of the limited partnership and not as individuals. In order for officers to have liability in the cases, in a case like this, you have to have allegations and proof that they're acting contrary to the corporation's interest and in their own interest, or pleading and proof sufficient to pierce the corporate veil. And they don't even get close to that. Regardless of the allegations made, once the defendants filed their special appearances, flatly denying that they had committed a tort in whole or in part in Texas, that negated all bases of jurisdiction alleged in that petition that are based on tort liability. And all the allegations in the petition are tort liability, primarily conspiracy to create a fraudulent lien. And then there are also some allegations about misrepresentations that led people to believe certain things.
Mr. Wineski?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's one allegation on page 4 of your brief that talks about what are things alleged in the Fourth Amendment petition.
Yes, Your Honor.
And one of them, at least to my reading, indicates a assertive conduct or an actual performance of an event by Hoskins and Eckels, in that they are renewed a note to Maricon, knowing that no collection efforts had ever been made on the original note, and I'm taking that means the original note that was to Zimmer,
that's correct, Your Honor.
Zimmer, that's right. And that, at least to me, is indicating a knowledgeable act on the part of Hoskins and Eckels after they have gone through the foreclosure, gotten off into a separate agreement, been released from their individual liability, and then here they are signing a note or agreeing for a renewal of the original note that had been cut off in the foreclosure.
That is what the allegation says. However, that allegation is not at all clear as to whether Hoskins and Eckel are taking this action in their individual capacities as individuals or as officers and directors of the Vista entity. And later on in the brief, we point out clearly several times where it is stated that Hoskins through Vista renewed the note, or that Vista through Hoskins renewed the note. And it's those allegations make it clear that what the plaintiffs are complaining about are actions that these guys have done in their capacity as corporate officers, not as individuals. There was a personal guarantee, or two personal guarantees, on the original note to Rico. Those were personal. Those were released after the foreclosure.
Right, I understand. That's what caused me to.
And those were the only individual acts that we have seen alleged in this entire petition.
Was there individual liability by guarantee on the note to Zimbo that was the original note from Vista to Zimbo?
I do not know, Your Honor. I have not
in the record anywhere. I didn't see that.
Not in the record. No, Your Honor. And I was not involved until after these. Well, the orders hadn't been signed yet, but the
I can tell where your involvement came in, Mr. Linnes.
Okay.
Thank you for answering my question.
So, if you will look at the trial court's conclusion of law number two, and I've got that set out on page 21 of my brief, and I've also got the full findings. I'm sorry, not 21. 23 of my brief, and it's also in the findings and conclusions that are attached in the appendix. The trial court expressly based its ruling on jurisdiction as follows. Defendants Hoskins and Echol need not have entered the state of Texas in the commission of their tortious acts as long as they had purposefully directed their activities toward this state and the litigation arises from those activities, and cites the Hagerty Partners partnership case as authority for that. That is the express basis for its ruling. And yet the Texas Supreme Court, 5 years earlier, in Kelly versus General Interior Construction, said, well, the court below reasoned that the officer's alleged fraud sufficiently relates to conduct purposefully directed toward Texas. Same language. But we rejected the concept of directed to tort jurisdiction in Michiana, instead affirming the importance of the defendant's contacts with the forum state. So that very order is based on law that has been rejected by the Texas Supreme Court, and not just in Kelly, but also in Michiana and in Gazprom and probably some others. Justice Gabriel, in an opinion that she authored last year, set forth the correct test. Specific jurisdiction still requires a substantial connection between the non-resident defendant's contacts with Texas and the operative facts of the underlying litigation. Thus, our focus is on the incidents made the basis of the plaintiff's suit and not on whether the defendants directed a tort or where the effects of tortious conduct will be felt. Now, in this case, the basic, if you boil down the petition, the basic cause of action is Echol and Hoskins individually engaged in a conspiracy with all these other defendants to create a fraudulent lien on the property. But the Texas Supreme Court in Michiana has said, no, we have rejected a jurisdiction based solely upon the effects or consequences of an alleged conspiracy in the forum state. So the trial court's ruling is based upon a theory that has been rejected and rejected repeatedly. In this case, focusing on the defendant's activities in Texas, again, there are no allegations in the plaintiff's petition of any specific action, as in, here is what this particular person did on this date, in this place, and here is the consequence that it had. Every allegation that's made is in general blanket form. And therefore, we believe that the allegations in the first instance were insufficient to confer jurisdiction. When we challenged those allegations by stating under oath that neither defendant had ever committed a tort in the state of Texas, that negated all of the bases of jurisdiction alleged by the plaintiff against them. And the plaintiff's failure to come back then, after the burden shifted back to them with evidence to substantiate even a single one of its allegations, was fatal to its cause of action against these two individuals. Therefore, the trial court erred in overruling those special appearances, and please forgive me if I've called them special exceptions. I can't stop myself from doing that. The trial court erred in overruling those special appearances, and this court should therefore reverse the order of the trial court and render judgment dismissing both Christopher Hoskins and Dennis Echol as individual defendants in this lawsuit.
I have one last question.
All right.
Yes, Your Honor.
What would be a benefit to either Hoskins or Echol from having this second Lynn be as alleged by Zimbois and their transferee?
I have been trying to figure that out from day one, Your Honor, and I cannot figure that out. I can't see any benefit.
Was anything in the arguments that you mentioned between counsel at the time of the special appearance hearing as to why they would have benefited from being involved in what was an alleged amorphous conspiracy?
No, Your Honor, not that I remember. I may be mistaken.
Thank you very much.
But I can't remember any.
All right, Mr. Wininski, thank you for arguing today. Your case is now submitted.
Mr. Wininski, are you going to do any rebuttal?
Don't believe so, Your Honor, unless you want to make an argument, I'll try to rebuttal.
Good to see you, sir.
We thank you again. As I stated, your case is now submitted. We have no further cases for today, so court will stand adjourned.
If I wore a skirt more, I think I'd be better off.
Struggles with that dress.
You're going to shorten yourself a little bit, Your Honor.
I didn't mean to do that.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.